I have a thing for contiguous vowels, and I'm considering calling them both Raoul. We settle on Joel, whom we'll only ever call Joey, and Leo, who defies all attempts at nicknames. They're the most fraternal twins I've ever seen. Joey looks like me, except with platinum blonde hair. Leo is a swarthy little Mediterranean man. If they weren't exactly the same size and constantly together, you wouldn't guess that they were related. I'll later find that a good tip-off that someone has no interest in babies is if they ask whether the boys are identical. After 4 long days, we're allowed to leave the hospital. Being at home with the boys is only marginally easier. In the early evenings, they wail for hours. Both wake up all through the night. Simon and I each pick a baby before we go to sleep and are responsible for that one the whole night. We each angle to pick the better baby, but who that is keeps changing. Anyway, we haven't yet moved into the larger apartment, so we're all sleeping in the same room. When one baby wakes up, everyone else does too. It still feels like there are more than two of them. I never thought I'd dress twins alike, but I'm suddenly tempted to do so just to create a little bit of order, at least visually, like making kids at a tough school wear uniforms. Amazingly, I still find time to be neurotic. I'm obsessed with the idea that we've given the boys the wrong names, and that I should go back to the town hall and switch them. I spend my few leisure minutes ruminating on this. Then comes a small matter of the circumcisions. Most French babies aren't circumcised. Mostly just Jews and Muslims do this. Because it's August in Paris, even the Moyles, who do ritual circumcisions, are on vacation. We wait for one who's been recommended, a man who is reassuringly both a Moyle and a pediatrician, to come back. Unlike the birth, the circumcision isn't two for the price of one. There isn't even a package discount. Before the little ceremony, I confess to the Moyle that I fear I've given the boys the wrong names and that I may need to switch them. He doesn't offer me any spiritual advice, but being French, he explains that the bureaucracy I'd need to go through to do this would be labyrinthine and excruciating. Somehow this information, plus the consecration of the circumcisions, erases my doubt. After the ceremony, I never worry about their names again. Thankfully, my mother has arrived from Miami. She, Simon, and I spend most of our time in the living room holding the boys. One day a woman rings the doorbell. She explains that she's a psychologist from the PMI office in our neighborhood. She says that she pays house calls to all mothers of twins, which I think is a tactful way of saying that she wants to make sure I'm not having a breakdown. A few days later, a midwife from the same PMI stops by and stands with me as I'm changing Joey's diaper. His poop, she declares, is excellent. I take that to be the official view of the French state. We're able to put some of what we've learned about French parenting to use in the boys. We slowly nudge them onto the national meal plan, with 4 feeds a day. From the time they're a few months old, except for the goûter, they never snack. Unfortunately, we don't get to try out the paws on them. Having newborn twins who don't even have a room of their own, and an older child who's just a few feet away, makes it difficult to try out anything. So, once again, we suffer. After about a month of almost no sleep, Simon and I are zombies. We fall back on our Filipina nanny and her network of cousins and friends. We eventually have 4 different women to help us, on shifts covering practically 24 hours a day. We're bleeding cash, but at least we're sleeping a bit. I start to view mothers of multiples as a persecuted minority, like Tibetans. Both boys have trouble breastfeeding, so I spend a lot of time upstairs in my bedroom, bonding with my electric breast pump. Bean eventually figures out that she can spend time alone with me if she sits with me while I pump. She learns to assemble the bottles and receptacles as if she's putting together a rifle. She does a great impression of the wappa-wappa sound the pump makes. Most of the time, I look like a stunned animal. I come downstairs to deliver my bottles of milk or send Bean down with them and go back to sleep. There are so many babysitters around that I feel more like a supporting cast member than a lead actress. I'm convinced the boys don't know that among all these women, I'm their mother. I must seem detached, Because at one point, a friend grabs me by the shoulders, stares me in the eye, and asks whether I'm okay. This isn't easy for her. She's quite a bit shorter than me. "I'm okay, but I'm running out of money," I say. I spend so much time singing Silent Night to the boys, more as a command than a lullaby, that one of the babysitters asks me if I become a Catholic. Meanwhile, our renovations are underway. Between pumping sessions, I dash over to inspect the new apartment. I meet with the head of the building association, an economist in his 60s, to discuss whether we can leave our double stroller in the vestibule downstairs. He won't commit.
"The previous owners were excellent neighbors," he says.
"Excellent how?" I ask.
"They were very discreet," he says.
The apartment itself is an enormous mess. I'd approved the plans one night, while the boys were having a full-on fit of colic. It's suddenly clear that I had no idea how to read them. 200-year-old doors and walls, which I had thought were fine, have been thrown away. They've been replaced with new, flimsy ones. It's only when the renovations are done and we move in that I realize I've turned our 19th-century Parisian apartment into what looks like a high-rise condominium in Miami, but with mice. I didn't understand quite how beautiful Paris is, the heavy doors, the intricate moldings, until I destroyed a small part of it, at enormous expense. Now I spend a lot of time ruminating on this. You know how Edith Piaf said, "Je ne regrette rien," I regret nothing, I ask Simon. Well, for me, it's "je regrette tout," I regret everything. Occasionally our life shifts from expensive and exhausting to merely surreal. When the boys are a bit older, a single girlfriend of mine stops by before bedtime one night. She watches as the boys, in footed pajamas, silently pull themselves up and down the furniture in a kind of Dadaist dance. Later, they'll march around silently while holding their toothbrushes aloft, like talismans. Simon watches them and pretends to narrate a documentary. "To these boys and their culture, toothbrushes are these curious status symbols," he explains. Mostly, our new life is full of extreme emotions. Simon mopes around in exhaustion and despair, taking little passive-aggressive snips at me. "Maybe in 18 years I'll get to have a cup of coffee," he says. He describes the dread he feels when he approaches our house and hears the wailing from outside. 3 kids under the age of 3 are a lot, even among our very fertile cohort. Amid all the crying and complaining, there are hopeful moments. My whole mood lifts one afternoon when Leo is cheerful and calm for 5 whole minutes. The first night that he sleeps 7 straight hours, Simon jumps around the house singing the Frank Zappa song, "Titties and Beer." Even so, I still feel much as I did at the moment of the boy's birth, that my attention is hopelessly divided. I ask my friend Hélène, who also has twins, and a singleton, whether she's considering having more.
"I don't think so. I am at the limit of my competence," she says.
I know exactly what she means. Only I fear that I've surpassed my competence. Even my mother, who spent years begging for grandchildren, tells me not to have any more kids. As if to cement my status, Bean comes home from school one day and announces that I'm a maman crotte de nez. I immediately type this into Google Translate. It turns out that she has called me a mommy booger. Given the circumstances, it's a very good description. Chapter 11. I adore this baguette. Friends tell me that parents of twins have a high divorce rate. I'm not sure this is statistically true, but I can certainly understand how the rumor got started. In the months after the twins are born, Simon and I bicker constantly. During one argument, he tells me that I'm rebarbative. I have to look up this word, too. The dictionary says, unattractive and objectionable, a rebarbative modern building. I march back to Simon. Unattractive? I ask. Even in our current state, that's a low blow. Okay, you're just objectionable, he says. To remind myself to be civil, I tape up signs around the apartment that read, Don't snap at Simon. There's one on the bathroom mirror in plain view of the babysitters. Simon and I are too tired to realize that we're fighting because we're tired. I no longer care what he's thinking about, though it's probably still Dutch football. During rare moments of leisure, Simon likes to burrow in bed with a magazine. If I dare to interrupt him, he says, There's nothing you can say to me that's more interesting than this article I'm reading in the New Yorker. One day I have a revelation. I think we're actually quite compatible, I tell him. You're irritable, and I'm irritating. Apparently, we send off a scary vibe. A childless couple we know comes to visit from Chicago and concludes, after 4 days, that they don't want kids after all. At the end of one weekend, en famille, Bean decides that she doesn't want to have kids either. Children are too difficult, she says. On a positive note for our relationship, we get spots in the creche for both boys. Even my mother is relieved to hear this. Twins are still uncommon enough in France that our application got priority status. The creche committee took such pity on us that they assigned the boys to a tiny creche 2 blocks from our new home, which I'd been told had no vacancies. The creche offers some hope for the future, but we still have to survive as a family and, perhaps more dauntingly, as a couple until we hand the boys over in a few months. We've decided to keep them at home until they're a year old. It's not always obvious that Simon and I will make it that long. It seems no coincidence that as concerted cultivation has become the de facto parenting style for the American middle class, research shows that marital satisfaction has fallen and that mothers find it more pleasant to do housework than to take care of their kids. American social scientists now pretty much take for granted that today's parents are less happy than non-parents. Studies show that parents have higher rates of depression and that their unhappiness increases with each additional child, or in Simon's case, with merely seeing those additional children on an ultrasound. Maybe we just need a date night. While I've been living in France, date nights have become the new penicillin for North American couples with kids. Hate your spouse? Have a date night. Want to strangle your kids? Go out to dinner. The Obamas go on date nights. Even social scientists now study them. A paper on middle-class Canadians found that when couples got leisure time alone together, it helped them tremendously as a couple, rejuvenated them personally, and re-inspired their parenting. But the couples in the study rarely got this time. Many participants felt pressured by the wider culture to always place the needs of the children above the needs of the partnership, the authors conclude. One husband said that while speaking to his wife, we would be interrupted on a minute-to-minute basis by the children. This is, of course, another consequence of concerted cultivation, which eats up leisure time and makes fomenting the child's development the family's overwhelming priority. I see this all around me when I visit the United States and the United Kingdom. An American cousin of mine, who's a nurse with 4 kids, has family nearby who'd be willing to babysit, but after a week of getting everybody to school, gymnastics, track meets, and church, she and her husband, who works nights as a policeman, don't even consider going out alone. They're too tired. A school teacher from Manchester, England, tells me that she's taking her toddler on her honeymoon, even though her mother has volunteered to watch him. I just feel too bad leaving him behind, she explains. Every Anglophone mother I speak to has a cautionary tale about a mother in her social circle who refuses to leave her child with anyone. These moms aren't urban myths. I frequently meet them. At a wedding, I sit next to a stay-at-home mother from Colorado who explains that she has a full-time babysitter but never leaves a sitter alone with her 3 kids. Her husband has skipped the wedding to look after them. An artist from Michigan tells me that she couldn't bring herself to use a babysitter for her son's whole first year. He seemed so tiny. He was my first kid. I'm really pretty neurotic. The idea of handing him over to someone? Some American parents I meet have adopted such specific diets and discipline techniques that it's hard for anyone else, even a grandparent, to take over and follow all the rules. A grandfather from Virginia says his daughter became livid when he pushed her baby's stroller the wrong way over a bump. The baby's mom had read that there's a smaller chance of brain damage if babies go over bumps backward. Obviously, Simon and I aren't against babysitters. We're currently employing half the Philippines. But since the boys were born, I haven't spent more than a few hours away from home. Mostly I do what that mother from Colorado does. I use the babysitter as a kind of assistant who changes diapers and does the laundry, but I'm usually on the premises. This system has the advantage of both depleting our savings and destroying our relationship simultaneously. I feel rebarbative much of the time. I realize I'm losing my mind a little bit when, about 15 minutes before one of our babysitters is supposed to arrive, my phone beeps, indicating that I have a new text message. I panic, fearing that the babysitter is late. In fact, it's a message from a news service that I subscribe to, informing me that there's been a deadly earthquake in South America. For an instant, I'm relieved. Of course, it's easier to get along with your spouse if your baby sleeps through the night by 3 months old, your kids play by themselves, and you're not constantly shuttling them from one activity to the next. It also helps that couples in France don't have some of the big financial stressors, like high costs for childcare, healthcare, and college. In the short term, however, what seems to really help is that French couples view romance differently, even when they have young kids. I get an inkling of this when my gynecologist writes me a prescription for 10 sessions of rééducation périnéale, perineal re-education. She did this for the first time after Bean was born, and again after the birth of the boys. Before my first re-education, I had only been vaguely aware that I had a perineum, or what exactly it is. It turns out to be the hammock-like pelvic floor area, which often gets stretched out during pregnancy and birth. The stretching loosens the birth canal and can cause mothers to pee a little bit whenever they cough or sneeze. In the United States, doctors sometimes suggest that women tone their perineums with Kegel squeezes. But often they don't suggest anything. Being a little slack and leaky is just a seldom-mentioned part of being an American mom. In France, such troubles are pas acceptable. Friends tell me that their French obstetricians gauge whether a few sessions of perineal re-education are needed by asking, "Is Monsieur happy?" I think my monsieur would be happy to have any access to my perineum. The region hasn't exactly lain fallow in the year or so since the boys were born, but I wouldn't say there's any danger of overuse. For a while, as soon as Simon went anywhere near my breasts, it was like a fire alarm. They began spurting milk. Anyway, sleep is more of a priority for us. Though all three kids now technically do their nights, somehow, I never seem to sleep more than 6 or 7 straight hours. I'm intrigued enough by the perineal re-education to give it a try. My first re-educator is a slim Spanish woman named Monica, with an office in the Marais neighborhood. Our introductory session begins with a 45-minute interview, during which she asks me dozens of questions about my bathroom habits and my sex life. Then I disrobe from the waist down and lie on a padded table covered with crinkly paper. Monica slips on surgical gloves and leads me in what I can best describe as assisted crunches for the crotch, in sets of 15, and up and release. It's a bit like Pilates for the below-the-belt region. Afterward, Monica shows me a slender white wand that she'll introduce in the next phase. It resembles a device you might see for sale in an adults-only shop. The wand will add electrostimulation to my mini-sit-ups. By the 10th session, we'll be ready to try out a kind of video game in which sensors on my groin measure whether I'm contracting the muscles enough to stay above a running orange line on the computer screen. Perineal re-education is at once extremely intimate and strangely clinical. Throughout the exercises, Monica and I address each other using the formal vous, but she asks me to close my eyes so I can better isolate the muscles where her hand is. My doctor writes me a prescription for abdominal re-education, too. She's noticed that, more than a year after the twins are born, I still have a kind of bulge around my waist that's part fat, part stretch, and part unknown substance. Frankly, I'm not sure what's in there. I decide that it's time to take action when I'm standing up on the Paris metro and a decrepit old woman offers me her seat. She thinks I'm pregnant. Not all French women do re-education after they give birth, but many do. Why not? France's national insurance picks up most or all of the cost, including the price of the white wand. The state even helps pay for some tummy tucks, usually when the mother's belly hangs below her pubis, or when it's inhibiting her sex life. Of course, all this re-education just gets mothers out of the starting gate. What do French women do once their bellies and their pelvic floors are back in fighting shape? Some do focus only on their kids, but unlike in the United States or Britain, the culture doesn't encourage or reward this. Sacrificing your sex life for your kids is considered wildly unhealthy and out of balance. The French know that having a baby changes things, especially at first. Couples typically assume that there's a very intense stretch after the birth, when it's all hands on deck for the baby. After that, gradually, the mother and father are supposed to find their equilibrium as a couple again. There's this fundamental assumption in France that every human being has desire. It never disappears for very long. If it does, it means you're depressed, and you need to be treated, explains Marie-Anne Suizot, the University of Texas sociologist who studied French and American mothers. The French mothers I meet talk about le couple in a whole different way from the American parents I know. For me, the couple comes before the children, says Virginie, the stay-at-home mom who taught me to pay attention to what I eat. Virginie is principled, smart, and a devoted mother. She's the only young Parisian I know who's an observant Catholic, but she has no intention of letting her romantic life slacken just because she has three kids. The couple is the most important, is the only thing that you chose in your life. Your children you didn't choose, you chose your husband, so you're going to make your life with him. So you have an interest in it going well, especially when the children leave. You want to get along with him. For me, it's prioritaire. Not all French parents would agree with Virginie's ranking, but in general, the question for French parents isn't whether they'll resume having full romantic lives again, but when. No ideology can dictate the moment when the parents will feel truly ready to find each other again, says the French psychosociologist Jean Epstein. When conditions permit and when they feel ready, the parents will give the baby its rightful place outside the couple. American experts do sometimes mention that parents should take time for themselves. In Dr. Spock's Baby and Child Care, which my friend Dietlin hands off to me before leaving Paris, there's a two-paragraph section called Needless Self-Sacrifice and Excessive Preoccupation. It says that today's young parents tend to give up all their freedom and all their former pleasures, not as a matter of practicality, but as a matter of principle. Even when these parents occasionally sneak off by themselves, they feel too guilty to get full enjoyment. The book urges parents to carve out quality time together, but only after making all the necessary sacrifice of time and effort to your children. French experts don't treat having quality time together as an afterthought. They're adamant and unambiguous about it. That's perhaps because they're very sanguine and upfront about how hard babies can be on a marriage. It isn't for nothing that a good number of couples separate in the first few years or the first few months following the arrival of a child. Everything changes, one article says. In the French parenting books I read, le couple is treated as a central and crucial topic. Some French parenting websites occasionally have as many articles on le couple as they do on pregnancy. The child must not invade the parents' whole universe. For family balance, the parents also need personal space, writes Hélène Delire-Snidière, the pediatrician. The child understands, without a clash and always very young, that his parents need time that's not about work, the house, shopping, children. Once French parents emerge from the initial cocooning period, they take this call to coupledom seriously. There is actually a time of day in France known as adult time or parent time. It's when the kids go to sleep. Anticipation of adult time helps explain why, once the fairy tales are read and the songs are sung, French parents are strict about enforcing bedtime. They treat adult time not as an occasional hard-won privilege, but as a basic human need. Judith, an art historian with three young kids, explains that all three are asleep by 8 or 8:30 because I need a world for myself. French parents don't just think these separations are good for parents. They also genuinely believe that they're important for kids, who must understand that their parents have their own pleasures. Thus, the child understands that he is not the center of the world, and this is essential for his development. The French Parenting Guide, Your Child Explains. French parents don't just have their nights to themselves. After Bean starts school, we are confronted with a seemingly endless series of mid-semester, two-week holidays. During these times, I can't even arrange a playdate. Most of Bean's friends have been dispatched to stay with their grandparents in the countryside or the suburbs. Their parents use this time to work, travel, have sex, and just be alone. Virginie says she takes a 10-day holiday alone with her husband every year. It's non-negotiable. Her kids, ages 4 to 14, stay with Virginie's parents in a village about 2 hours by train from Paris. Virginie says guilt doesn't enter into this holiday. With what you construct between the two of you when you're away for 10 days, it has to be good for the kids too. She says that kids also occasionally need space from their parents. When they all reunite after the trip, it's very sweet. The French parents I meet grab adult time whenever they can. Caroline, the physical therapist, tells me without a trace of guilt that her mother is picking up her 3-year-old son from maternelle on Friday afternoon and looking after him through Sunday. She says that on their weekend off, she and her husband plan to sleep late and go to the movies. French parents even get pockets of adult time when their kids are home. Florence, 42, with three kids ages 3 to 6, tells me that on weekend mornings, the kids don't have the right to enter our room until we open the door. Until then, miraculously, they've learned to play by themselves. Inspired by her story, Simon and I try this. To our amazement, it mostly works, though we have to reteach it to the kids every few weeks. I have trouble explaining the concept of a date night to my French colleagues. For starters, there's no dating in France. Here, when you start going out with someone, it's automatically supposed to be exclusive. In France, a date sounds too tentative and too much like a job interview to be romantic. It's the same once a couple lives together. Date night, with its implied sudden switch from sweatpants to stilettos, sounds contrived to my French friends. They take issue with the implication that real life is unsexy and exhausting, and that they should schedule romance like it's a trip to the dentist. When the American movie Date Night comes to France, it's titled Crazy Night. The couple in the film are supposed to be typical suburban Americans with kids. A reviewer for the Associated Press describes the pair as tired, ordinary, but reasonably content. In an opening scene, they're awakened in the morning when one of their children pounces on their bed. French critics are horrified by such scenes. A reviewer for Le Figaro describes the kids in the film as unbearable. Despite having kids who don't pounce on them in the morning, French women would seem to have more to complain about than American women do. They lag behind Americans in key measures of gender equality, such as the percentage of women in the legislature and heading large corporations. And they have a bigger gap than we do between what men and women earn. French inequality is especially pronounced at home. French women spend 89% more time than men doing household work and looking after children. In the United States, women spend 31% more time than men on household activities and 25% more time on child care. Despite all this, my American and British girlfriends with kids seem a lot angrier at their husbands and partners than my French girlfriends are. I am fuming that he doesn't bother to be competent about a whole slew of stuff that I ask him to do, my friend Anya writes to me in an email about her husband. He's turned me into a shrewish nag, and once I get mad, It's hard for me to cool back down. American friends, or even acquaintances, regularly pull me aside at dinner parties to grumble about something their husbands have just done. Whole lunches are devoted to such complaints. They're indignant about how, without them, their household would have no clean towels, living plants, or matching socks. Simon gets many points for effort. He gamely takes Bean across town one Saturday to get some American-sized passport photos. But in a typical twist, he returns with photos that make Bean look like a 5-year-old psychopath having a bad hair day. Since the boys were born, Simon's incompetence is less charming. I no longer find it adorably mystifying when he breaks the second hands on all his watches or reads our expensive English-language magazines in the shower. Some mornings, our whole marriage seems to hinge on the fact that he doesn't shake the orange juice before he pours it. For some reason, we mostly fight about food. I put up a "Don't snap at Simon" sign in the kitchen. He leaves his beloved cheeses unwrapped in the refrigerator, where they quickly dry out. When the boys are a bit older, Simon gets a phone call while he's brushing their teeth. I take over, only to discover that Leo still has an entire dried apricot in his mouth. When I complain, Simon says he feels disempowered by my elaborate rules. When I get together with my Anglophone girlfriends, it's just a matter of time before we start venting about such things. At one dinner in Paris, 3 of the 6 women at the table discover, in a ricochet of Me Too's, that their husbands all retreat to the bathroom for a long session just when it's time to put the kids to bed. Their complaining is so intense, I have to remind myself that these are women in solid marriages and not on the verge of divorce. When I get together with French women of the same social class, this type of complaining doesn't happen. When I ask, French women acknowledge that they sometimes have to prod their husbands to do more around the house. Most say they've had their sulky moments when it felt like they were carrying the whole household while their husbands were lying on the couch. But somehow in France, this imbalance doesn't lead to what a writer in the best-selling American anthology, The Bitch in the House, calls the awful, silent process of tallying up and storing away and keeping tabs on what he helped out with and what he did not. French women are no doubt tired from playing mother, wife, and worker simultaneously, but they don't reflexively blame their husbands for this, or at least not with the venom that American women often do. Possibly French women are just more private, but even the mothers I get to know well don't seem to be secretly boiling over with the belief that the life they have isn't the one they deserve. Their unhappiness seems like normal unhappiness. No matter how much I dig, I don't find rage. Partly this is because French women don't expect men to be their equals. They view men as a separate species, which by nature isn't good at booking babysitters, buying tablecloths, or remembering to schedule checkups with the pediatrician. "I think French women accept more the differences between the sexes," says Deborah Olivier, author of What French Women Know. "I don't think that they expect men to rise to the plate with the same kind of meticulous attention and sense of urgency." When the French women I know mention their partners' inadequacies, it's to laugh about how adorably inept the men are. "They're just not capable. We are superior," jokes Virginie, as her girlfriends chuckle. Another mother breaks into peals of laughter when she describes how her husband blow-dries her daughter's hair without brushing it first, so the little girl goes to school looking like Don King. This outlook creates a virtuous cycle. French women don't harp on men about their shortcomings or mistakes, so the men aren't demoralized. They feel more generous toward their wives, whom they praise for their feats of micromanagement and their command of household details. This praise, instead of the tension and resentment that builds in Anglophone households, seems to make the inequality easier to bear. "My husband says I can't do what you do," another Parisian mom, Camille, proudly tells the group. None of this follows the American feminist script, but it seems to go a lot more smoothly. 50-50 equality just isn't the gold standard for the Parisian women I know. Maybe this will change one day, but for now, the mothers I meet care more about finding a balance that works. Laurence, a management consultant with 3 kids, has a husband who works long hours during the week. She has switched to part-time. The couple used to fight all weekend about who does what. But lately, Laurent has been urging her husband to go to his Aikido class on Saturday mornings, since he's more relaxed afterward. She'd rather do a bit more childcare in exchange for a husband who's cheerful and calm. French mothers also seem better at giving up some control and lowering their standards in exchange for more free time and less stress.
You just have to say, I'm going to come home and there's going to be a week's worth of laundry in a pile, Virginie tells me when I mention that I'm taking Bean to the United States for a week and leaving Simon in Paris with the boys.
There are structural reasons why French women seem calmer than American women. They take about 21 more vacation days each year. France has less feminist rhetoric, but it has many more institutions that enable women to work. There's the national paid maternity leave. The United States has none. The subsidized nannies and crèches, the free universal preschool from age 3, and myriad tax credits and payments for having kids. All this doesn't ensure that there's equality between men and women, but it does ensure that French women can have both a career and kids. If you drop the forlorn hope of 50-50 equality, it becomes easier to enjoy the fact that some urban French husbands do quite a lot of childcare, cooking, and dishwashing. A 2006 French study found that just 15% of fathers of infants participated equally in the baby's care, and 11% took primary responsibility. But 44% played very active supporting roles. You see these dads, adorably scruffy, pushing strollers to the park on Saturday mornings and bringing home bags of groceries afterward. This latter category of dads often focused on housework and cooking in particular. The French mothers I meet often say their husbands handle specific domains, like homework or cleaning up after dinner. Perhaps having this clear division of labor is the secret. Or maybe French couples are just more fatalistic about marriage.
One of the great feelings of a couple and of marriage is gratitude to the person who hasn't left, says Laurence Ferrari, the anchorwoman of France's top nightly news program. Ferrari, 44, is a pretty blonde who's 6 months pregnant with her second husband's baby. She's speaking to the raffish, professionally provocative French philosopher Pascal Bruckner. The two are discussing love and marriage. Are they a good combination? For a French magazine. Ferrari and Bruckner are part of the French elite, a rarefied circle of journalists, politicians, academics, and business people who socialize with and marry each other. Their views represent an exaggerated, perhaps aspirational version of how ordinary French people think.
Today, mariage no longer has a bourgeois connotation. To the contrary, for me, it's an act of bravado, Ferrari says.
Mariage is a revolutionary adventure, Bruckner replies. Love is an indomitable feeling. The tragedy of love is the fact that it changes, and we are not the masters of this change.
Ferrari concurs.
It's because of that as I persist in saying mariage for love is a magnificent risk.
In a sign of how far we've come socially, Simon and I are invited away for the weekend, with kids, to the country home of my French friend Hélène and her husband William. They too have twins and a singleton. Hélène, who's tall, with a heart-shaped face and ethereal blue eyes, grew up in Reims, the capital of the Champagne region. Her family's vacation home is nearby in the Ardennes, close to the Belgian border. Many of World War I's battles took place in the Ardennes. For 4 years, French and German soldiers dug trenches on opposite sides of a narrow stretch of territory called No Man's Land and fired artillery and machine guns at each other. The two sides lived in such close proximity that they knew each other's work shifts and habits the way neighbors do. Sometimes they'd hold up handwritten signs for the other side to read. In the small town where Hélène's family home is, it feels as if the shelling only recently stopped. People here don't say World War I. They say 14 to 18. Many of the homes and buildings destroyed in the war were never rebuilt, leaving a lot of the landscape covered in fields. Hélène and William are ultra-dedicated parents all day long, but I notice that each night we're there, as soon as the kids are down, they bring out the cigarettes and the wine, turn on the radio, and have what is obviously adult time. They want to profiter, to take advantage of the company and the warm summer night. Hélène is so keen to profiter one afternoon when we're driving with the kids that she pulls over to a field in the late afternoon, whips out a blanket from the trunk, and produces cake for our goûter. The setting is so picture-perfect. It's almost more pleasure than I can handle. On weekends, William gets up early with the kids. One morning he pops out of the house, while Simon babysits, to fetch some fresh pain au chocolat and a crusty baguette. Hélène eventually wanders downstairs in her pajamas, her hair adorably mussed, and plops down at the breakfast table.
J'adore cette baguette.
I adore this baguette, she says to William, as soon as she sees the bread he's bought. It's a very simple, sweet, honest thing to say, and I can't imagine saying anything like it to Simon. I usually say that he's bought the wrong baguette, or worry that he's left a mess that I'll have to clean up. I tend not to wake up feeling very generous toward him. He doesn't make me beam with delight, at least not first thing in the morning. That sheer girlish pleasure,
j'adore cette baguette,
sadly doesn't exist between us anymore. I tell Simon the baguette story as we're driving home from the Ardennes, past fields of yellow flowers and the occasional stone war memorial.
We need more of that, j'adore cette baguette, he says.
He's right. We absolutely do. Chapter 12. You Just Have to Taste It. The main question people ask about twins, besides how they were conceived, is how they're different from each other. Some mothers of twins have this all figured out. One's a giver and one's a taker. The mother of 2-year-old girls cooed when I met her in a park in Miami. They get along perfectly. It's not quite that smooth with Leo and Joey. They seem like an old married couple, inseparable, but always bickering. Perhaps they've learned that from Simon and me. The differences between them become clearer when they start to talk. Leo, the swarthy one, says nothing but the odd noun for several months. Then suddenly at dinner one night, he turns to me and says, in a kind of robot voice, I am eating. It's no accident that Leo has mastered the present progressive. He lives in the present progressive. He's in constant, rapid motion. He doesn't walk anywhere. He runs. I can tell who's approaching by the speed of the footsteps. Joey's preferred grammatical form is a possessive, my rabbit, my mommy. He moves slowly, like an old man, because he's trying to carry his key possessions with him at all times. His favorite items vary, but there are always many of them. At one point, he sleeps with a small kitchen whisk. He eventually puts everything into 2 briefcases, which he drags from room to room. Leo likes to swipe these, then run away. If I had to sum up the boys in a sentence, I'd say one's a taker and one's a hoarder. Bean's preferred grammatical form is still the command. We can no longer blame her teachers. It's clear that giving orders suits her. She's constantly advocating for a cause, usually her own. Simon refers to her as the union organizer, as in, the union organizer would like spaghetti for dinner. It was hard enough trying to instill Bean with French habits when she was an only child. Now that there are 3 kids in the house, and just 2 of us, creating some French cadre is even harder. But it's also a lot more urgent. If we don't control the kids, they're going to control us. One realm in which we're succeeding is with food. Food is, of course, a source of national pride in France, and something that French people love to talk about. My French colleagues in the office where I rent a desk spend most of lunch discussing what they had for dinner. When Simon goes out for post-game beers with his French soccer team, he says they talk about food, not girls. It becomes clear how French our kids' eating habits have become when we visit America. My mom is excited to introduce Bean to that American classic, macaroni and cheese from a box. but Bean won't eat more than a few bites. That's not cheese, she says. I think I detect her first sneer. We're on vacation when we visit America, so we end up eating out a lot. On the plus side, American restaurants are a lot more kid-friendly than those in France. There are unheard-of conveniences like high chairs, crayons, and changing tables in the bathrooms. You might occasionally find one of these in Paris, but almost never all three at once. But I grow to dread the ubiquitous kids' menus in American restaurants. It doesn't matter what type of restaurant we're in, seafood, Italian, Cuban. The kids' menus all have practically identical offerings. Hamburgers, fried chicken fingers, now euphemistically called chicken tenders, plain pizza, and perhaps spaghetti. There are almost never any vegetables, unless you count French fries or potato chips. Occasionally there's fruit. Kids aren't even asked how they want their hamburgers cooked. Perhaps for legal reasons, all the burgers come out a depressing shade of gray. It isn't just restaurants that treat kids as if they don't have fully developed taste buds. On one trip home, I signed Bean up for a few days of tennis camp, which includes lunch. Lunch for 10 children turns out to be a bag of white bread and 2 packages of American cheese. Even Bean, who'd eat pasta or hamburgers for every meal if I let her, is taken aback. "Tomorrow is pizza," one of the coaches chirps. The reigning view in America seems to be that kids have finicky, limited palates, and that adults who venture beyond grilled cheese do so at their peril. This belief is, of course, self-fulfilling. Many of the American kids I meet do have finicky and limited palates. Frequently, they spend a few years on a kind of mono diet. A friend in Atlanta has one son who eats only white foods, like rice and pasta. Her other son eats only meat. Another friend's baby nephew in Boston was supposed to start eating solid foods around Christmas. When the boy refused to eat anything but foil-wrapped chocolate Santas, his parents hoarded bags of them, afraid they'd be out of stock after the holidays. Catering to picky kids is a lot of work. A mother I know in Long Island makes a different breakfast for each of her 4 kids, plus a 5th one for her husband. An American father who's visiting Paris with his family informs me in reverent tones that his 7-year-old is very particular about textures. He says the boy likes cheese and tortillas separately, but refuses to eat them when they're cooked together because the tortilla becomes, he whispers this while looking at his son, too crispy. Instead of resisting this pickiness, the parenting establishment is capitulating to it. What to expect, the toddler years says. Letting a young child go for months on nothing but cereal, milk, and pasta, or bread and cheese, assuming a few well-chosen fruits and or vegetables are thrown in for good balance, isn't indulgent or unacceptable, but perfectly respectable. In fact, there's something inherently unfair about insisting that children eat what's put in front of them when grown-ups enjoy a great deal of freedom of choice at the table. And then there are snack foods. When I'm with friends and their kids in America, little bags of pretzels and Cheerios just seem to appear all the time in between meals. Dominique, a French mother who lives in New York, says at first she was shocked to learn that her daughter's preschool feeds the kids every hour all day long. She was also surprised to see parents giving their kids snacks all throughout the day at the playground. If a toddler starts having a tantrum, they will give food to calm him down. They use food to distract them from whatever crisis, she says. The whole picture is different in France. In Paris, I mostly shop at the local supermarket, but just by going with the middle-class flow, my kids have never tasted high-fructose corn syrup or long-life bread. Instead of fruit roll-ups, they eat fruit. They're so used to fresh food that processed food tastes strange to them. As I've mentioned, French kids typically eat only at mealtimes and at the afternoon goûter. I've never seen a French child eating pretzels or anything else in the park at 10 a.m. There are kids' menus at some French restaurants, usually at corner bistros or pizza places. These menus don't always have haute cuisine either. There's often steak with frites, French fries. At home, we never have frites. My kids know it's their only way of getting them, my friend Christine says. But at most restaurants, kids are expected to order from the regular menu, When I ask for spaghetti with tomato sauce for bean at a nice Italian restaurant, the French waitress very gently suggests that I order her something a bit more adventuresome, say the pasta dish with eggplant. McDonald's does a thriving business in France, and you can certainly find processed foods to eat if you want them. But a government campaign reminding people to eat at least 5 fruits and vegetables per day has become a national catchphrase. A popular lunch restaurant in Paris is called Cinq fruits et légumes chaque jour, 5 fruits and vegetables every day. Though French kids eat hamburgers and fries sometimes, I've never met a French child who ate just one type of food or a parent who allowed this. It's not that French kids are clamoring for more vegetables. Of course they like certain foods more than others, and there are plenty of finicky French 3-year-olds. But these children don't get to exclude whole categories of textures, colors, and nutrients just because they want to. The extreme pickiness that's come to seem normal in America and Britain looks to French parents like a dangerous eating disorder, or at best, a wildly bad habit. The consequences of these differences are important. Just 3.1% of French 5- and 6-year-olds are obese. In America, 10.4% of kids between 2 and 5 are obese. This gap is much wider for older French and American kids. Even in prosperous American neighborhoods, I see fat children all the time. But in 5 years of hanging out at French playgrounds, I've seen exactly one child who might qualify as obese, and I suspect she was just visiting. With food in particular, I can't help but ask the same question that I've been asking about so many other aspects of French parenting. How do French parents do it? How do they make their kids into little gourmets? And in the process, why don't French kids get fat? I see the results all around me. But how do French kids get to be this way? I suspect that it starts with babies. When Bean is around 6 months old and I'm ready to feed her solid foods, I notice that French supermarkets don't sell the ground rice that my mother and all my Anglophone friends say should be a baby's first food. I have to trek to health food stores to buy an expensive, organic version imported from Germany, tucked away below the recycled diapers. It turns out that French parents don't start their babies off on bland, colorless grains. From the first bite, they serve babies flavor-packed vegetables. The first foods that French babies typically eat are steamed and pureed green beans, spinach, carrots, peeled zucchini, and the white part of leeks. American babies eat vegetables too, of course, sometimes even from the start. But we Anglophones tend to regard vegetables as obligatory vitamin delivery devices and mentally group them in a dull category called vegetables. Although we're desperate for our kids to eat vegetables, we don't always expect them to. Best-selling cookbooks teach parents how to sneak vegetables into meatballs, fish sticks, and macaroni and cheese without kids even noticing. I once watched as friends of mine urgently spooned vegetables coated in yogurt into their kids' mouths after a meal while the kids watched television, seemingly oblivious to what they were eating. "Who knows how much longer we'll be able to do this," the wife said. French parents treat their legumes with a whole different level of intention and commitment. They describe the taste of each vegetable and talk about their child's first encounter with celery or leeks as the start of a lifelong relationship. "I wanted her to know the taste of carrot by itself. Then I wanted her to know the taste of zucchini," swoons Samia, the mother who showed me topless pictures of herself. Like other French parents I spoke to, Samia views vegetables, and also fruits, as the building blocks of her daughter's incipient culinary éducation and a way of initiating her into the richness of taste. My American baby books recognize that certain foods are an acquired taste. They say that if a baby rejects a food, parents should wait a few days and then offer the same food again. My Anglophone friends and I all do this, but we assume that if it doesn't work after a few tries, our babies just don't like avocado, sweet potatoes, or spinach. In France, the same advice to keep reproposing foods to babies is elevated to a mission. Parents take for granted that, while kids will prefer certain tastes over others, The flavor of each vegetable is inherently rich and interesting. Parents see it as their job to bring the child around to appreciating this. They believe that just as they must teach the child how to sleep, how to wait, and how to say bonjour, they must teach her how to eat. No one suggests that introducing all these foods will be easy. The French government's free handbook on feeding kids says all babies are different. Some are happy to discover new foods, others are less excited, and diversification takes a little bit longer. But the handbook urges parents to be dogged about introducing kids to new foods and not giving up even after a child has rejected a food 3 or more times. French parents advance slowly. Ask your child to taste just one bite, then move on to the next course, the handbook suggests. The authors add that parents should never offer a different food to replace the rejected one, and they should react neutrally if the child won't eat something. If you don't react too much to his refusal, your child will truly abandon this behavior, the authors predict. Don't panic. You can keep giving him milk to be sure he's getting enough food. This long-term view of cultivating a child's palate is echoed in Laurence Pernod's legendary parenting book, J'élève mon enfant. Her section on feeding solids to babies is called How Little by Little a Child Learns to Eat Everything. He refuses to eat artichokes, Pernod writes. Here again, you have to wait. When a few days later you try again, try putting a little bit of artichoke into a lot of puree, for instance, of potatoes. The government food guide tells parents to offer the same ingredients prepared many different ways. Try steaming, baking, in parchment, grilled, plain, with sauce, or seasoned. The handbook's authors say your child will discover different colors, different textures, and different aromas. The guide also suggests a talking cure, a la Dolto. It's important to reassure him and to talk to him about this new food, it says. The conversation about food should go beyond, I like it, or I don't like it. They suggest showing kids a vegetable and asking, do you think this is crunchy? And that it'll make a sound when you bite it. What does this flavor remind you of? What do you feel in your mouth? They suggest playing flavor games like offering different types of apples and having the child decide which is the sweetest and which is the most acidic. In another game, the parent blindfolds the child and has him eat and identify foods he already knows. All the French baby books I read urge parents to stay calm and cheerful at mealtimes and, above all, to stay the course, even if their child doesn't take a single bite. Don't force him, but don't give up on proposing it to him, the government handbook explains. Little by little, he'll get more familiar with it, he'll taste it, and, without a doubt, he'll end up appreciating it. To get more insight into why French children eat so well, I attend the commission menus in Paris. It's here that those sophisticated menus posted at Bean's Crèche every Monday get their final imprimatur. The commission decides what the crèches of Paris will be serving for lunch for the subsequent 2 months. I'm probably the first foreigner to ever attend this meeting. It's held in a windowless conference room inside a government building on the banks of the Seine. Heading the meeting is Sandra Merrill, the chief nutritionist at Parisian crèches. Merrill's deputies are also there, along with a half-dozen chefs who work in crèches. The commission is a microcosm of French ideas about kids and food. Lesson number one is that there's no such thing as kids' food. A dietitian reads out the proposed menus, including all 4 courses for each lunch, as if she's entering them into the official record. There is no mention of French fries, chicken nuggets, pizza, or even ketchup. The proposed menu for one Friday is a salad of shredded red cabbage and fromage blanc. This is followed by a white fish called colline in dill sauce and a side of organic potatoes à l'anglaise. The cheese course is a colomiere cheese, a soft cheese similar to brie. Dessert is a baked organic apple. Each dish is cut up or pureed according to the age of the kids. The commission's second lesson is the importance of variety. Members take a leek soup off the menu when someone points out that the children will have eaten leeks the previous week. Meryl scratches a tomato dish she had planned for late December, another repeat, and replaces it with a boiled beet salad. Meryl stresses visual and textural variety, too. She says that if foods are all the same color one day, she inevitably gets complaints from Klesch directors. She reminds the Klesch chefs that if the older kids, meaning 2- and 3-year-olds, have a pureed vegetable as a side dish, they should have a whole fruit for dessert, since they might find 2 pureed dishes too babyish. Some of the chefs boast about their recent successes.
"I served mousse of sardines mixed with a little cream," says a chef with curly black hair. "The kids loved it. They spread it on bread."
There is much praise of soup.
"They love soup. It doesn't matter which beans or which vegetables," another chef says.
"The soup with leeks and coconut milk, they really like it."